Welcome to the Troubleshooters podcast with me, your host, Mike McGrath. Now, Nicole Stanners is the founder of Muse, a cycling apparel brand that she launched in 2023, which is going gangbusters. Like most great business ideas, this came to Nicole, who's a keen cyclist, seeing a problem with poorly fitting cycling apparel for women, and then she took some action. Sit back as I learn how Nicole went from marketing executive to online entrepreneur. So, Nicole, welcome to the Troubleshooters podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I feel like I know you, even though it's the first time we met this morning, because just to declare an interest, I know your dad quite well, and he's been keeping me up to date on your progress since you launched your business. And the last time we had a chat, I said, we must get Nicole in, so here you are. Thank you. Now, Muse is a female cyclist apparel, so that's the thing that's emerged, right? And so, like most great businesses, your business started when you identified a problem. So you're a very keen cyclist, and you were presumably having trouble getting decent female cyclist apparel. Is that how you conceived the idea?
Yeah, I think I've always been into sport and really passionate about it. A lot of running, team sports when I was younger. But I first started in triathlon and cycling about 14 years ago.
Wow.
And I remember I was really excited to get my first club kit, and I tried it on and looked at it in the mirror and just thought to myself, oh my God, is this as good as it gets? You know, it didn't fit, it didn't look great, didn't complement the body. It was pretty bad. So
was it largely, had it been produced for males, or was it, what was the deal at those days?
I think, you know, probably back then everything was pretty standardized, and right. You know, there's this term in the industry that's called shrink it and pink it.
Okay.
So I think what happened is they would just have smaller male cut sizes,
right,
and try to put a bit of a female design on it.
Okay.
Things have improved, but there's still a bit of that going on, and not a lot of catering for women, you know, designing from the ground up, I suppose.
Okay. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, many great businesses start from that premise of, you know, someone's got an interest in an area, they see a problem and they say, look, how can we fix it? But it takes, you know, many of us identify those problems, but not many of us do something about it. So ostensibly, what did you do about it? What was your first action around, okay, maybe I'm going to do something about this?
Well, that was the seed, and I think that kept germinating away in my head because I was working in marketing and corporate,
right,
and kept thinking to myself, is this an opportunity? And certain things I experienced over the next probably, 5 to 7 years, just cemented that in my mind.
Right.
So I remember going, I used to work for Campari and I was in Italy, and actually stumbled across an Italian cycling race just for amateurs one day when I was there, and they were wearing the worst kit ever, and I thought, how can this be happening in Italy?
Wow.
And then I did lots of different cycling events, in particular one called Race Across America, which is a cycling race from one side of the US to the other.
5,000 kilometres?
Yeah, 5,000 kilometres.
Crazy. You know,
six times Everest in climbing.
Is that right?
Yeah, so it's pretty epic.
So is it west to east?
It goes from Oceanside in California to Annapolis in Maryland.
Wow.
Yeah. And just, you know, experiencing 6.5 days in cycling kit day after day also just reinforced that. I started initially just looking at, you know, the size of the market, was it growing, how many females were in that space, and then started to do a little bit of research on factories and suppliers while I still had my corporate job.
Yeah. So look, let's go back a bit. So you're a marketing person. You were the marketing director at Campari Group. I mean, and you were there, I don't know, 8 years or so. I mean, that was a big gig, really. And then you'd previously worked for Diageo and Arnott's, and then Unilever. So you were a thoroughbred marketing corporate, really.
Yeah.
So did that help? Did that perspective around, okay, what's the market opportunity here, did that help?
Yeah, I think my background in marketing and innovation really helped to I suppose, you know, I had my consumer head on looking at, you know, what it felt like to be a cyclist, but also from a marketing perspective. And I think going back to your point of lots of people have good ideas, but it's about executing it. You know, I wasn't the first person to come up with that insight that things aren't great for women. So that definitely got me moving, I suppose.
And so that was germinating. You were kind of prosecuting your corporate career. So when did you begin to take some steps, maybe some more concrete steps? Because most of us start moonlighting a bit, you know, before we jump. So what was going on there?
Once I had the idea, I think I started to do the research. I also started to do some prototyping of kit that I thought would be good. Also looking at partners to work with and suppliers, which was extremely hard because it's quite a protected industry. People protect their factories, the people they work with. So it's hard to
So it's hard to break into that kind of supply chain area. You're a startup, no one knows you. Okay, and I suppose you're upsetting the apple cart a bit with some of the ideas, maybe.
Yeah, a lot of factories, they prefer to work with people that are already established. Yeah. Plus, if you want to do any variation on a standard cut of kit, that's a bit of a headache for them as well.
So what was the solution in essence? And I mean, clearly the female body is different to the male body. Well, I'm not sure I can say that anymore, but anyway, I've said it. So, but I presume that you had to do some real research and some real testing around that. So how did you go about fixing the problem, I guess?
I think I had some intuition myself and also just talking to friends. And then initially what I did is did the common marketing thing. I did some focus groups with some friends, triathletes and also cyclists.
You'd be amazed how many people don't do that, though.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just, your marketing background would have helped with that because... That's not as common as you might think.
No, exactly. You don't want to be just basing it on your own thought. And then once I had some decent prototypes, I actually did some fit testing just to see how it fit on the body for women of different sizes and body shapes. And then also just pedaling on an indoor bike. What did that look like? What did it feel like? Okay. I worked with a designer for that and also someone called an anthropometric expert.
I read that. I'm not sure I could say it, but I had a crack at it in my head.
I know. And they're an expert on body measurements and, you know, mapping of sizes and patterns and things. So she was really useful in helping me look at patterns, how things needed to be shaped and sit on the body in order to establish my first proper prototypes of production.
So is that a combination between comfort and looks, I guess? Yes, isn't it? That sort of, how can we make it comfortable? How can we make it look okay?
Yeah, and she can also help you commercially looking at, you know, if you're going to do six sizes, what's the best breadth for each of those sizes to make it commercially viable and get less returns as well.
Yeah, okay. So,
when I launched Muse, I think the three big things I wanted to focus on besides technical, performance was... getting a flattering fit. Yeah. So making sure women felt good, they felt comfortable, they could forget about it and just perform. Even things down to where the zipper sat and where the print sat on women, that makes a difference in making you look good as well.
Yeah.
The second area was practical design features. So things that are important to men, but mostly to women. So I've got things like a ponytail holder in your cap or a heart rate monitor sleeve in your crop top. So different things like that. And then lastly, just making sure that it's as sustainable as possible. Okay. Fashion's one of the biggest contributors to climate issues.
Yeah, and I heard that.
So you want to take a step in the right direction. It can't be perfect from day one, but really trying to do that. And then just creating a brand that really supports women, so helping to overcome barriers and inspiring them to get on the bike.
Yeah, so how did you come up with the name Muse?
It was funny because I think the marketing perfectionist in me wanted to absolutely nail it. So I was procrastinating quite a lot. And actually initially one of my friends, I had a catch up with her and she said, Muse sounds really cool. What about that? And she owned her own business. So she suggested it. And then I thought, actually that fits really well because the brand is about inspiring women, having women as the muse for creating the brand, not men. I quite like it.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I like it too. Memorable.
Yeah.
You'd be amazed how many tech companies that I come across with the most extraordinary names so unmemorable. And I'm like, that is not, you've not spoken to a marketing person about this. Okay, that's interesting. So you've got your brand, you've got, and so when did you leave your corporate role?
Yeah, it was interesting because I was trying to do stuff on the side and, you know, had a pretty busy corporate role. And, you know, talking to people now, they always say, you know, you sort of got to jump at some stage because while you're trying to do everything, you're just not putting 100% in. So I was actually at the point at the beginning of 2020 or even 2019, thinking about if I jumped out now, could I do consulting on the side or something? And I was lucky enough that Campari restructured Asia Pac in 2020. So I was able to get a redundancy. So that was a really nice step to move into actually taking it on full time.
So I suppose essentially you're starting with a whole prototyping and then beginning to get products, and that's all money out the door.
Yeah, it is.
So did you squirrel some money away? Did you have to borrow anything? Well, how did you get it funded?
No, everything for me is bootstrapped. So yeah, I tried to
start.
That's
often the way, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it has to be. And even looking back now, I think I could have bootstrapped a lot better. You know, I'd have sage advice to give to some people, but yeah, that's definitely what I'm doing. I think it's great. Like, you really, you know, you come from corporate where you've got millions of dollars for budget and you have to think about every dollar when you're in your own business.
Yeah, it's so true that. I mean, necessity is a mother of invention. So if you haven't got access to capital and cash, you've got to find another way. And that's often part of the testing, proving process, I think, with a new business.
Yeah.
I mean, bearing in mind that 60 or 70% fail within 5 years. I mean, and, you know, over 20% fell in the first year. So, you know, the odds are stacked against you. Mm. So the less you borrow, probably the better.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So, and then how did you go about placing your first order? I mean, that would have been quite a sort of, I don't know, it's a big moment, that, isn't it? When you're actually, it's the moment where you say, okay, can I sell this stuff?
Yeah, exactly. That's quite scary. I think I had a couple of bumps along the way. So my intention was to launch 12 months earlier than I did in the end. It's always better to launch coming into the summer season, you know, springtime for a cycling brand.
And that's springtime in Australia?
Yeah.
So you're Australian, selling to Australian market at this stage?
Yeah, initially. When you're global, it's a little bit different. Yeah. But I was working with a factory. I'd prototyped a lot of stuff here in Australia and then gone to a factory to really perfect it.
Yeah.
And when we went to... So we were perfecting me as the prototype size, which is like a size 8. And then what we wanted to do, luckily, was we did a size set. So from 6 to 16 of certain items, just to see how the grading had worked and how the pattern worked in different sizes. And that should have worked really well, but it was a disaster.
Right.
And so something had happened in how the factory had interpreted the grading, and basically the sizes as you got bigger were not fitting in the right places, so particularly on the bibs. So I had to take a deep breath and say, this is terrible, but it could have been worse. Imagine if I'd gone into production. So really only cost me the prototypes.
Okay.
But what that also meant is we missed the window to launch that year.
Interesting, right.
Yeah. So what I did more is sort of pivot and focus on a pre-launch phase so that I could then launch the next year.
Okay.
I think...
So that was your first major setback, really?
Yeah, really
okay.
was.
Okay. And so what... I mean, that was just get back on the bike and start pedaling again, wasn't it, to use a metaphor?
I've had a few moments since I've started where I go, you know, there's a sense of urgency to push things through, but it's like, no, do the right thing. Okay. You know, what could be the worst scenario of either decision is what I say to myself now.
Yes.
And in that case, it was like, no, take the time and do it in 12 months.
Okay, yeah. No, that's interesting. Sometimes you've got to kind of play the long game, haven't you? You sort of...
Yeah.
It's not a 5-minute job building a business. I mean, it can look like that when we pick the paper up and we see a success story, which looks like an overnight success.
No, it's not.
But in reality, it's often taken years. I mean, I would even say that yours has taken a lot longer than it looked, because all that marketing experience you're putting in every day, aren't you? One way or another, you're pulling on it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I probably got a little more patience because my background in, I've worked in various marketing product categories, but in spirits, when you grow a spirits brand, the best formula is to grow it slowly. So establishing a core community, getting them as influencers, and then sort of growing from there, you know, starting in the on-premise environment and then bringing it into the off-premise environment. So that's sort of the mentality I've had in growing the brand as well.
So that's very interesting, because that's a sort of a guerrilla approach in a way, isn't it, where you get your early adopters that then become the fans. And so just knowing and understanding that conceptually, and then you've used that, I guess, with Muse.
Yeah, having a spiritual home, et cetera, leveraging community, so using a lot of that.
And then being a keen cyclist
is
essential, isn't it, I guess, in a way, because, you know, you're, otherwise it's just a product.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you just, you know, whilst you try to listen to everybody else, I think understanding that market as a consumer yourself is always really important, and being connected to the community, knowing.
Okay. So that's interesting. So you've got a factory, they're being supportive, bit of a blip, costs you 12 months, not easy. You eventually get that right and you put an order in, and then I presume that's in the Far East, and then the gear arrives. Right. So what was the next step?
Yeah. Well, actually, I produced in Italy too.
Did you? Okay. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So I think there's sort of big hubs of
production. I mean, that's how the coronavirus spread, isn't it? Apparently, all the from Wuhan, all the flights were to Italy,
to Milan. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was one of the challenges when you first start, is a lot of people won't work with startups, no matter how polished you look. And then also the minimum orders high. So I just looked at lots of different options, and I ended up in Italy there. Also, from a sustainability perspective, it's quite good.
Okay. No, that's interesting. So you get it made in Italy. It's a big order. You had to put your cash up, no doubt. So it arrives. I presume you had a plan at that point of how you're going to sell it, but that's a plan at that stage. So what actually happened?
Actually, that part wasn't too bad, because I'd had 12 months. I was like, okay, now I'm going to focus on building the community before and teasing everything before it arrived. Okay. So the day I launched, I did a pre-launch out to the community. So I'd really focused on building a database and, you know, email, social media following.
Right.
Day one of pre-launch, and then the next couple of days was the actual launch. I was really, really happy with that fact.
So this is online. You've got a website which you spent time on.
Yeah.
You got an e-commerce element to that. Mm-hmm. And so you were using social media, I guess. That was, you were familiar with what that was going to take.
Yeah.
And I suppose it's relatively cost-effective, that.
Yeah, I think, the elements I used were, building my database, sending out on email, social media, PR, ambassadors, you know, connecting into cycling clubs. I think the heyday, really, of e-commerce brands was probably around 2013-14 when you didn't have all the algorithms and things happening. It's still good, and you still should focus on an organic community, but something that I'm doing more now is, paid advertising in that area.
Okay.
You just can't get the scale and the reach that you used to, so that has to be part of it as well.
Yeah. So what was the reception like?
It was really great.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah. A lot of support, and it's funny, you go through ups and downs sort of along the journey, and then little things happen that just make your day. I remember it was probably about 3 months ago, a lady, because I'm a new brand, I'm really focused on fit, I do a free fit exchange if you get the wrong size, and a lady had exchanged a pair of bibs. And she sent me a beautiful card back with a beautiful note just thanking me for what I was doing to cater for women cyclists.
Yeah.
And, you know, stuff like that just makes you really
happy.
Yeah,
so I suppose, we need that kind of encouragement, don't we? Because it sort of endorses what you're doing, because you can get lost in the detail and the fast becomes the sort of mundaneness of it all, yeah.
Yeah, and also you go through, you know, roller coaster initially of like no donut days, you know, no sales to start with, and then you'll get great sales and, you know, just trying to really understand also what's going to work as a marketing lever to bring people in.
So you, the website's going well. So what are you doing? Are you getting out into the community? Do you go? Are there any kind of trade shows? I mean, what are the other avenues that you were looking at?
Yeah, so I'm doing, there's obviously all the online activity.
Yeah.
But one of the other things I've been doing is events. So going to cycling events or triathlon events.
Yeah.
I think the most important thing with events is to look at the types of people that are attending. You know, for me, I'm a female brand, so I have to have good representation of women. And I've also found events that cater for serious right down to, you know, sort of the amateur. So a really great event for me has been Brisbane Cycling Festival.
Okay.
You know, they've traditionally had a professional series race, a qualifier for world championships for amateurs, right down to a family ride. So you get a lot of females in that expo. Also, who you're working with as well, are they establishing a really good flow of athletes through to the expo as well?
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah, they've been fantastic because I think people, your e-commerce brand fits really important. People want to try things on. They also get quite excited about meeting the founders and hearing the story as well.
Yeah, okay. And so that, so do you find that... have you ventured into sponsorship yet? I mean, if you got any other leading female cyclists that, you know, are endorsing Muse or, I mean...
At this stage, I mean, I'm working sort of, you know, I've got a retired professional cyclist, Chloe Hosking, who owns her own bike brand as well.
Okay.
She just started up. She has been wearing the Muse kit and we've done some things together.
Great.
We did a collaboration ride a couple of weeks ago, so that's been great. My focus, though, has been mostly on people that are micro-influencers or they can influence the local community at this stage to get that grassroots happening. And then also doing some community rides and sponsoring those. So in Queensland, I work with a couple of female groups. And so they're a female triathlon group and a cycling group. And so we do collaboration rides with them.
And I know that, you know, cycling is dominated in Europe, right, in terms of perhaps the US. And I know it had a big spike in the UK after the Olympics there. But how are we doing in Australia with our cycling and particularly female cycling? Have we got some good cyclists?
Yeah, we have. I think, Australia really punches above its weight in terms
of... It does in so many sports, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you look at, I think traditionally or historically, if you were an Australian, you wanted to cycle professionally, you had to pack your bags up and go off
to Europe,
sort of solo, no support.
Right.
Whereas these days, you know, there's more of a transition for athletes to go professional over there. And Australian teams like Jayco Alula, for example, for men and women, are Australian. So I think Australia does really well. Cadel Evans has obviously won the Tour de France. And you've got, you know, Grace Brown won a gold medal at the Olympics last year as well.
Okay, so it's happening. It's important that, isn't it, that for a sport, it's the trickle-down effect's quite phenomenal when you get local successes.
Yeah. I think the interesting thing about cycling that I've found, I've spoken to many people in the industry as I've been developing the brand just to try to get some learnings for them to mentor me a little bit in the business journey. And someone said to me, the interesting thing about cycling is that the amateur everyday weekend warrior doesn't always even know who some of those professional cyclists are. Whereas if you're in soccer or something like that, you've probably got a better sense of that.
Okay, that's interesting.
Then that's why sometimes it's hard if you just focus on endorsing and sponsoring those professional teams, because actually it's not going to resonate at that local level with everyone. If you're a super passionate cyclist, absolutely. But people that ride socially, not often. So what's important, I think, is to make sure that you're really connected at that grassroots level.
Where do you go from here? So you know, starting to get some traction, you've got sales online. I presume, I mean, just before we go to the future, how have you got over the whole distribution side of things? So, you know, you get the, you know, your your apparel arrives in Australia and then you've got to get it to customers, right? So the challenge with online is that whole cost of distribution. How's that? And Australia's a big country, so
yeah. You
can be sending it all over the place.
Yeah.
So how have you figured that out?
I think the good thing about launching an e-commerce business these days is there's a lot of templating that happens. So, you know, you can set up a Shopify website, which is a platform I'm on.
Yeah.
You've got plugins that can take you to that distribution and last mile. So at this stage, I work with a plugin called ShipStation and then also with Australia Post.
Right.
They might be a bit more expensive, but at least you know that your package is going to get to the end consumer. So to be honest, that's probably been an easier part. I think the challenging thing is I'm getting orders overseas now. So you really need to start thinking about tariff situations, duties, you know, you can put all those disclaimers if you're shipping from Australia, which I am at the moment. But once you start to get bigger, you need to think about 3PLs, where you're going to base things. So,
yeah, okay, that's interesting. And I mean, do you have plans internationally? Do you think that's what, you know, that you can end up doing a lot overseas?
Yeah, I think so. Okay. I mean, the beauty of having an e-commerce business these days is you can go overseas. And I think to scale, you need to.
Yeah, you bet. Okay. And so what's the future for Moos? Are we going to sell it to Adidas for you one day? I mean, what?
Oh, I'd love to do that. I think it's interesting. You look at, I think the journey of an e-commerce business, of most businesses, it's like you get set up.
Yeah.
And now what I mean, you set up, calibrate, scale, and, you know, take it into the future or sell it or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm definitely in calibration stage.
Okay,
so I think a few things, I'm actually changing factories.
Okay.
Just looking at something that's more cost effective and streamlined and can help me in the innovation space and improve COGS. Then the other piece is just really understanding what marketing levers are working best for you.
Yeah.
And just, I'm in a stage of really tightening everything up.
Yeah.
The other thing I've done, I think, in terms of the stock is looking at the sizing that works for me. I was probably surprised that women sort of size 12 upwards haven't been catered for very well. So that's where I'm selling out the sizes. So reorientating the whole business.
Yeah.
In the next stage, I think it's definitely, you know, growing overseas and scaling. And, if I could sell the business one day, that would be fantastic.
But I suppose the key thing is that I just want to talk to you a little bit about the differences between your corporate career and what you're now seeing. So what was it? Do you miss anything about the corporate life?
I do miss some things. I miss working with people more.
Yeah.
I find myself it's you know, a solo journey. You could be working from home a lot.
Yeah.
So I miss that part of it. It's interesting because I'm still doing consulting into FMCG and alcohol. And I do consulting projects, which gives me a little taste of that. But then when I see all the bureaucracy, I don't miss that.
Yeah. What was the big shock for you? Like, you know, you can simulate working for yourself, but then when you jump and you jump in and you hold your nose. So what were the things that you weren't expecting in the first 12 or 18 months that you were like, wow?
You hear all the people say these things about going out on your own, but you hear it, but you don't really understand it, I don't think, until you're in that space. For me, it's like there's always something to do.
Yeah.
The other surprise in me is probably, you know, I've always been quite motivated and determined and everything, but I think what's been flexed more in this space is my hustle.
Yeah.
Like I'm not scared of, well, I'm still scared, but I just do more of negotiating, asking people for help, which I probably wasn't good at before.
Yeah.
Also just being, you know, running and making decisions with not as much information or time to ponder. You just have to go or, you know, ask yourself a quick question. Is this going to change the trajectory of the business tomorrow, in the future or not?
Yeah. So you're moving faster, would you say, than you used to?
Yeah, exactly.
I think we see that a lot. We hear that a lot, that it's just faster.
And less
ready,
perfect.
You're ready, fire aim. Yeah, hey?
Less perfect. I was a bit of a perfectionist before.
Yes, okay. Now, that's interesting. And you're developing those hustle skills, that's part of the necessity, isn't it? You know, if you asking for discounts and, you know, changing minimum orders and being cheeky, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. They can always say no.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And so are you enjoying it?
Yeah, I do. I do love it.
Okay.
I think over my corporate journey, I think, you know, when I started, or even say 10 years ago, I didn't think I wanted to start my own business.
Okay.
But I think along that journey, I've ended up in probably more entrepreneurial roles or situations in corporate.
Yeah.
That really gave me a buzz. Okay. And so that started to direct me to this space. And yeah, I'm loving it. I'm loving the part of learning new skills. I really like seeing the immediacy with things as well.
Yes.
And you know, if I can create a brand that's remembered for challenging the status quo or the orthodoxy that
yes.
is in cycling at the moment, and really support the women who buy me, that
yeah,
would be great.
Yeah. It's interesting, you know, we talk to lots of business owners and, you know, who've built businesses over 20, 30, 40 years. And, you know, the last thing that an owner wants to think about is selling it, because that's a daft idea, really, mm. especially when you're building it.
Yeah.
And that kind of takes care of itself, if that's a thing. But I think the main thing is enjoying it and then, you know, de-risking a bit as you go. You don't want to be living on the edge mm. all your life, right? And that's what you're saying, really, that you're in that phase of tidying it up and
yeah.
and stiffening up a bit and, mm. you know, making sure it's sustainable and stuff.
Yeah.
And I think if you're enjoying it, there is a sense of achievement. And also there can be a sense of freedom. There's always something to do, but you're not actually reporting in anymore and
yeah.
writing reports for other people, are you?
Yeah. And you can set things to your vision. I think probably yeah. at times I was trying to be too challenging. You know, I could see opportunities I felt were worthwhile going after, but then when it gets into the corporate space, it's too risky. So, you know, being an entrepreneur, you can start to satisfy
yeah.
that need.
So how would you develop your vision for moving overseas? Where do you go first? What do you, you know, how does that, I mean, I presume you try and repeat what you've done here, do you?
Yeah, I think that I'm not saying this is my intention. I've done a little bit of testing. You know, I've got an ambassador in New Zealand and we've started to talk about things there. I think it's important to understand the structure a little bit there. I mean, I've worked in regional and global roles within corporate and I know, you know, there might be, say, 60% of it that you can plug and play into different places, but you need to know how to adapt it to that market. I think the easiest first step is to go somewhere that's most similar. So New Zealand, UK, you know, maybe one state of the US. So for example, in California, I'm talking to someone at the moment who has a marketplace website. She's taking to physical that's female focused.
Okay.
So that's a really nice step in the water to see
yeah.
how that might work.
Yeah. And do you ship direct from your manufacturer to them or do you shipping out of Australia? What would
At
you
the
do?
Moment, I'm just shipping yeah, out of okay. Australia. I think I need to ship from Australia
okay.
to get proof of concept. I mean, my whole yeah, idea yeah. on the whole thing is proof of concept, then scale and
yeah,
find
yeah.
a solution.
And I mean, how are you managing? I mean, I've done a fair bit of that sort of consumer product, you might say, and the perennial challenge is inventory, right?
Yeah. My God.
How much yeah. is the ultimate crystal ball gaze, right?
Yeah.
How many shall I order, right? And how many can I sell, which is more important.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I presume you're kind of managing that the best you can, really.
Yeah, I mean, that's really hard. I'd add another one to the mix is how many will the factory let me make?
Yeah,
exactly. Or not, how many are they going to make me make? Yeah, I think that would be another big learning. You never know. You start with this product range
mm.
and you don't necessarily know what's going to sell.
Okay.
Like a good example, a couple of things that I've probably tweaked over time when I did research with my mates and different people on colours. Lots of women say, I don't want to wear pink.
Right.
Yet pink has sold its socks off.
Is that right?
Yeah. Also, my other point before about, you know, the sizing, you know, you do see the majority of cyclists are probably those smaller sizes, but that's like the red ocean where everyone's focusing, whereas women of bigger sizes, they're not okay. being catered for. So
I must say,
that.
I mean, you don't see many fat cyclists, right? That's for sure. And if you do, they're not fat for very long normally. So
yeah.
I presume there is a predominance to smaller sizes, but you're saying, no, you're seeing larger sizes.
I think that's, I go back to, I love a book called Blue Ocean Strategy.
I've read that, yeah.
And basically that's all about, you know, not fishing in the red ocean where the sharks are, looking for blue ocean where you can create your own rules. I think it's really competitive in that, you know, in the cycling market. And, you know, I think women that are smaller sizes are probably reasonably well catered for by unisex brands. You know, issues with pattern making doesn't come into play until you grade it, and then the issues get bigger.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of women that are bigger aren't catered for. So that's going to be a big focus for me and sort of blue ocean, I suppose.
As cycling's growing and female sports growing, I suppose the trick is trying to tap into that, you know, and that's for the sport itself, is you know, how can we get more people cycling that aren't doing much movement? I mean, the great benefit of cycling is it's easy on your joints, isn't it? Relative to running, say.
Yeah.
And particularly if you're a bit bigger.
Yeah. And you can look at the stats, like I had a good look at, there's participation surveys that are done on cycling, and women that cycle once a week, there's about 330,000 of those. So they're regular, whereas women who actually ride, it's about 780,000 a year. So, you know, could you get more of those casual cyclists?
And that's in Australia, is it?
Yeah, that's in Australia. Yeah.
So they're quite big numbers, aren't they?
Yeah.
Excellent. Look, that's been such fun to find out about your journey. Look, before we kind of let you go, tell us a key attribute that you've had to draw on to really get this thing going and keep yourself moving forward. I mean, what attribute? Is it persistence or is it something else?
Yeah, I'd say persistence and resilience.
Yeah,
persistence that I think you know, we talk about business failure, but I think they probably just give up too early. You've got to go through the roller coaster, learn from it and be persistent. And also I think be resilient, because there's some tough days, but then there's some good days, like when you get a card from a customer, for example.
Yeah, no, excellent. Isn't that true? So, yeah, persistence is key and reoccurring theme, really. You've got to keep at it. It takes much longer to build something good, takes much longer than you'd like it to.
Yeah, definitely.
Interestingly, before we go, there's about 22% of female founders in Australia. So if you look at the million businesses, about 22% of them have been founded by females. And, you know, that probably needs to rise. And maybe people can look to you and look to others and jump in. Hold your nose and see what happens.
Yeah, that was
thanks
great.
For coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So there you have it. Nicole saw a problem, verified it, mused on the idea, then, after biding her time, took some action. More power to her and others like her. Quick piece of trivia, the country with the most female entrepreneurs is Ghana at 47%. Come on, ladies, there's work to do. If you want some great female cycling apparel, be sure to check out Muse. The details will be in the show notes. Now, before I go, a shout out to Oasis Partners, who sponsor this podcast. For corporate advice with a practical bias, call the guys at Oasis Partners. Now, if you like this content, be sure to tell your friends. And if you're feeling really generous, leave us a review. Until next time.